On the homepage of the New York Times last weekend, down in their video player section, was a video of Lee Summit resident Joe Hope talking about his struggles with schizophrenia. In particular, the voices.
The voices are saying he hates you. He's not listening. He doesn't like you. I'll turn and say, is it possible he is? Is it possible he does? And it's like the voices, they may pout or say no, but at the same time, they'll quiet.
I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll hear Joe's story, how he found a way to manage his own mental illness, and then go on to help others through his work as a counselor and foster parent. We'll hear his story in his own words coming up on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Pills and a bottle of whiskey, a loaded gun, a high bridge jump, hanging, walking into traffic, a drug overdose. For many mentally ill people, at their numbing, horrible breaking points, it's sometimes not a question of whether to commit suicide, but how. In the end, some of these people find help, solace, inspiration, purpose, hope. And those are the fortunate ones. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. The New York Times recently profiled one such person, Joe Hope, a Lee Summit native diagnosed with schizophrenia. The chilling story of being on the brink and edge and backing away, slowly, methodically, toward a stable life. That same Joe Hope is here now, live in our studios, to tell his story and to inspire others who may be going through similar travails. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you.
Tell us about your average day. Not so average. Not so average Joe, right?
Not anymore. I get up at around 4 in the mornings. My wife starts feeding our tube-fed baby. And I go through a ritual that I call my positive prayer ritual while I'm getting ready. Then I try to be at work. I'm at a workout by 5. And then at 6, I'm at work at one job programming. When I complete that, then I start my second job, which is counseling.
This is a daily routine.
A daily routine.
A daily routine.
Goes till about 9 at night, Monday through Friday.
So Joe Holt, a schizophrenic, is a father with 2 jobs.
Yes.
How does balancing severe mental illness with a lot of responsibilities sit with you? How do you do it?
Well, it's much easier now because I've learned so much over the 31 years of wrestling with it. But in essence, I do it with routines. I do it with self-soothing. And I do it mostly with remembering that my main objective in life is loving. And as long as I do that, I usually, everything else works out.
What is your official diagnosis, Joe?
It changed throughout the years, but the last official one that I've got was schizoaffective with bipolar tendencies.
Schizoaffective with bipolar tendencies. So a venerable cornucopia of
yes, and on the side note, there were borderline tendencies in there too, so it wasn't pretty.
Wow. So what is that what does that entail? I mean, that's obviously a formal medical diagnosis and opinion, but what does that entail for you?
Well, for me, it entails hearing voices. I have seen things, but very rarely hallucinations. Also struggles with self-image and anger and many of those sort of things. So, and societal adjustments, learning to fit in society.
You have to fit in into a sense of quote-unquote normalcy.
Yes, and know what that means to begin with.
And know what that means to begin with.
Yeah.
And Joe, you were hesitant to do any interview about such a private matter. That's an understandable thing. What made you, number one, do the Times piece and decide to do that? And then further, what made you sit down here with us on Central Standard today?
Well, I have said no so many times it's ridiculous. I think the Times piece, when I used to interview with religious groups, because I have a faith based life too, they would try to get me to say once I was saved, everything became perfect, which it didn't. And on the academia side, they wanted to leave out the faith. I just wanted to tell the story and let people do what they did, learn from it, get what they get from it.
So you found that perhaps different schools of thought and different areas of philosophy around mental illness or around torment were trying to maybe co-opt you to push their agenda.
Influence it a little too much. I just feel like it needs to just be honest. I like, to me, there are beautiful pieces of me. There are ugly pieces of me. They're both me. And I think both have to be honestly told if you're really going to make a difference in this world. Because there are people, when I was homeless, and I've been homeless twice in my life, I felt such a wreck, so worthless, so useless, and so helpless. And I wanted people to know my many failures as much as what they conceive as success now.
Do you ask yourself, speaking of being homeless and speaking of your background as an orphan, do you ask yourself, am I mentally ill or environmentally damaged?
I used to. I believe now both are true. There is a genetic history in my family that goes back a long way. There are suicides. So that's present. Also, environmentally, I did suffer extreme abuse and more than likely molestations and bullying and all sorts of things. So I had every reason to fail environmentally, too. It's not the most important question to me anymore.
Anymore, but before you wrestled with that,
for
whether
years.
It was environment or whether it was psychosomatic.
For years and years, because I thought it was vital that I knew the answer to that.
Did the homelessness start just because of the trouble at home life and you said, I got to get out of here?
No, actually, my parents, I was 16 years old and my mother and stepfather moved away from Kansas City and left me on the streets the first time. The second time I was 20 years old, I was in the middle of the worst episode that I ever had and I was homeless for a period during that, 6 months to 8 months, I'm not sure, because I was not very present.
Wow, Joe. A lot of homeless men and women, Joe, suffer with mental illness. Do you feel like you narrowly escaped that fate, being one of those nameless, faceless people out on the street maybe having a conversation with themselves and you don't know why and they just label them crazy?
I still to this day, the greatest fear that I have to comfort and soothe every day, every single day, is the fear that I'll walk out the door, go back to the streets, because there is a pull that I can't explain. I think it's fear-based. So, yes, I not only think I narrowly escaped, but I think I narrowly. Anyone that asks me, I say I'm what I call a cliff dweller. I've got to remain on the right side of the hill, you know, of the mountain.
You fear sometimes, you say in the New York Times piece and in the accompanying video, that you fear sometimes that you'll wake up and today will be the day that I go insane, or today will be the day that everything clicks off, or today will be the day that I'm done with it all. How do you deal with that in the moment?
Well, it's much easier now because I've, for so many years, practiced calming and soothing myself that now it's almost, I know, within a 30-minute time frame, that's why that morning period that I talked about, the positive self-talk and prayers are so important to me. But now it's such a routine that I believe it's possible. For years and years and years, the first 10 years, I thought it was impossible. Now I know it's possible. I just have to convince myself each day that it is, and each week sometimes when it really gets overpowering.
What was your aha moment, your epiphany moment, where you realized it might have been psychological and that there might be some psychiatric aspects of why you were out there?
Well, my wife and I were very close in the early 90s to divorcing because I thought she was cursing me and telling me how worthless I was. And we'd have these yelling, screaming matches. I would, she wouldn't, where I would attack her and accuse her. And I was in mental health working in the field as a tech. And I was about to get promoted. And she took me out to eat to promote me. I thought she was taking me to fire me. And when she promoted me, we were having a great meal. She turns to walk out the door or walk to the bathroom. And I heard her curse me. and say very insulting things. And I jumped up and started to run out the door like I had for many of the 61 jobs I've had in my life. And
61 jobs.
Yes. I'm on my 61st job now. And there one thing saved me in that moment. There was, you'd think when somebody yells and curses and makes a scene in a restaurant that everyone would stop and look, even for a second, and no one did. And it completely baffled me. And also it hit me that we had had a pleasant conversation, and I turned and looked, and I just knew it couldn't have happened. She came back, and I tried to jokingly ask if she'd said it, anything, or heard anybody cursing or anything, and she kind of looked at me, and that look just burned into me. And I went outside, and I knew many things in that moment that I must be hearing things that aren't there. I must be perceiving something that isn't true. And I thought of the many times I'd accused my wife, and it was a very overwhelming day. I truly don't know how I made it through that day.
And that's when you realized you were hearing voices.
That's when I accepted that it was true, and I knew that I had to start relying on my wife and other close people to tell me when I was experiencing, in their view, unrealistic actions, words, or expressions. And I've tried very hard to lean on them more and trust them and take the medication and do whatever it took.
We're here with Joe Holt, a Lee's Summit resident who is diagnosed as a schizophrenic and has come from the brink of suicide to a productive, thriving career, a fulfilling fatherhood, and a strong marriage, to become a counselor, and he works in IT as a programmer, of all things. He's our guest today on Central Standard, 89.3 FM, KCUR, and streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Joe, you reached a moment of clarity when you were talking about you realized that these voices weren't real in the sense that other people were saying what you thought that they were saying, but they were real in the sense that you were hearing them in your own mind. How do people with schizophrenia and with your condition reach that self-awareness stage and catch their minds from breaking with reality, external reality?
That's a good question. I can only tell you what I did. I'm afraid to say someone else's way of doing it. The only guess that I can take is if you just listen to those around you that seem to love you a great deal and try to trust them. I don't honestly know the answer because I really suffered for almost 20 years before I came to that realization.
Speaking of suffering, the Times piece led with your job being gone and your gun was loaded and you heard voices prompting you to give up and saying, do it, it's a waste. Do you mind at all, Joe, taking us briefly to that moment in your life and sharing what got you there and sharing what got you out of it?
It was my 58th job. And it was a local job, and up to that point, I had worked two jobs at a time and barely making a living. And it was quite an offer at that time to me. And I worked there less than a year, and they laid me off. Now, they laid 1,000 other people off, so I really shouldn't have taken it the way that I did. But it was so defeating because it was my 58th job, and I felt that I'd let my wife down. I was going to have to go back to the two jobs a day thing. I just thought, I've tried long enough. It was 11 years ago, and I just thought it was over. And I truly, I had allowed myself up until that time to consider suicide as an option, and I literally had a gun in my hand and was going to kill myself over it.
Joe, as the saying goes, recession is the other guy losing his job, depression is you losing yours, and that's sort of what you were going through. And so the gun's sitting there, and your wife comes in, and you hide it. What happened from there?
Well, she walks in, and I didn't remember her seeing the gun. She tells a different story now, so I trust her story better than mine. And the only thing that I remembered was that she was teary-eyed, and she looks me deep in my eyes, and she says, Joe, I know you're so devastated over this, but if you quit now, you never know if tomorrow things might work out at the job, everything. Please don't quit. And she walked out. She told me later that she was just waiting for the gunshot. So she did see it. But I didn't think she did. And I sat and stared at the gun for an hour. And I made the life-altering decision that suicide could never be an option again. I took the gun the next day and sold it and have never allowed myself to have a gun again, even though now I don't have, you know, that tremendous of urges. But I think cutting that out as a possibility was very helpful, because every time a problem would come up, I'd think about suicide, and it was every day up to that point.
And we're glad you sold that gun, Joe, because you're here to tell a very inspiring story.
Well, the truth is, the very next job set me free, so I would have missed out on all of the blessing of life. Up to that point, it just seemed like such a curse.
And you're saying something that I'm sure a lot of men say or are forced to say, my wife was right.
My wife. Yes. Yes.
Kansas City, do you know people, or have you suffered yourself with mental illness? How have you come to terms and come to peace with your own inner struggles? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We want to hear your story. We want to hear you share with Joe Holt. And you can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're having a discussion about Joe Holt, father, husband, counselor, Lee Summit resident, diagnosed schizophrenic, who's getting through it. What are the voices say? How do they interact with you? How do you corral that? Kind of like a conference call of the mind.
It sounds like to me and feels like an audible voice, just as you and I are talking. It's usually loud or screaming. Sometimes it's a whisper, but most of the time it's loud or screaming. And did I answer your question? Give me that again. I'm sorry.
Most of the time it's loud or screaming. Do you hear them now, for instance?
Yes.
What are they saying? Can you share that with us?
I'm worthless and I shouldn't be doing this.
Wow. So it's the little hater inside, essentially.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
How do you communicate back?
Most of the time, if it's not like today, it's not severe and overwhelming. I just comfort and soothe myself at the same time. I'll talk to myself. I never let it go unless it's too overwhelming. Like if it's in a low key, like what I consider this moment, I'll sit and tell myself either mentally or out loud that it's not my truth. It could be that I'm an okay guy now. If it's overwhelming, then I just ride it through because I've lost my objectivity. And I try to just let it ride like a thunderstorm or a tornado, just let it go through me and then try to get my objectivity back before I try to correct it or fix it.
You're talking about losing your objectivity and staying objective.
Yes.
In the moment.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's vital to me that I objectively approach a problem, not with too much emotion, not with too much opinion when I'm overwhelmed. So I have to calm myself to the point to where I know I can objectively look at it, not subjectively. Because subjectively, I can hear, I think everyone struggles with self-doubt. But when I'm hearing the voices, they're telling me, they're commanding me, they're telling me that I'm worthless. And if I can stay in an objective state, I can at least know inside me what's the best routine, calming it or just letting it ride through me. You know, you meet screamers on the streets from time to time. Sometimes you just listen. Sometimes you protect and defend yourself. It's hard to know which. You're taking a guess in the moment, and that's kind of what I've learned to do.
And sometimes they make sense, and
sometimes they don't. Yeah.
How do you keep now from recrossing the boundary or revisiting the boundary to where you get low again and you're considering ending it all?
Well, I go back to that day in 2001 when I made the commitment. Every time it comes through my mind, I believe in challenging that thought. Suicide is not an option. It cannot be. What next? What can I do? What are we going to do? That's the way that I approach it. I refuse to even consider suicide as an option.
We're going to go to Bob in Midtown. Hello, Bob. Welcome to Central Standard. Bob, you there? Bob's not there. Under what circumstances are you surviving? Give us four or five steps on how you get through your illness and live a stable life, because it's not normal in the sense of normal, but it's stable and it works for you. How do you do that?
Routines are vital. When I'm in a good state, I practice my routines harder than when I'm in a bad state. When I'm in a bad state, I barely am surviving, so I don't think as much. It does no good. I usually think in negatives or I'm too overwhelmed. So in other words, what I'm thinking of is if I train myself in routines, that keeps me employed. And so my body is almost on automatic pilot during those periods. When I'm in a good place, I practice my thoughts. I never allow a thought to go through my head without challenging it, if it's negative. I believe fear is the greatest destroyer. And I don't believe in allowing fear to go through me without correcting it. So if I'm in a good state, I will turn and address it directly right then. I don't let it go. I don't let it settle in my body. I believe it's toxic. I believe it's poison to my mind and body. So that's my daily routine in a nutshell.
Speaking of daily routine, let's talk about the interesting juxtaposition of your profession. You decided to be a counselor, a grief and substance abuse and psychological counselor.
Yes.
And you're also in IT.
Yes.
So tell us how you balance those disparate fields. What do you do in IT, first of all?
Well, actually, I'm a tester. I take tests that are created, and I either help perform those manual tests, or I create through the IT automated tests that run them millions of times. And so I do that for the Marines.
What type of test? A system test? Operational?
Yes, a web test of programs that the Marines use. So,
and you're a programmer.
I do have programming skills. Yes, they have me do a very basic programming. But yes, I am a
writing
programmer.
Code.
Yes,
being creative.
Yes.
How did you get into that?
I worked in mental health, and even at mid-management, I was barely able to make a living. And once we started taking on foster kids, I said, I've got to do something to make a living. My wife noticed I was building computers, and she said, why don't you do computers? And so I went back to DeVry and got my programming degree and started working. And it guarantees that I can work in mental health no matter how much or how little money I make. And it's my stabilizer. It also helps me raise the kids that we take on. So.
Foster kids and being a counselor, do you feel, Joe, that service has also helped become sort of a medicine for you?
Well, the only thing I can say to that is kids they give me hope even when everything else looks so terrible about the world. When I see kids, they do something to me. They keep me going. Everything else in the world can be messed up, but those kids, knowing they need me, knowing that they love me and I can love them and that I can make a difference, that's really what I live for. I think it's what God created me for. The rest of it, I do to pay for that.
There's a saying about children that they're closer to God than we are, and they remind us. Do you feel that way?
Yes, the simplistic faith and trust they have in me that is vital for me to honor. Yes.
Karen in Kansas City, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you having a show on this subject. It's so rare that I hear really honest discussion about it. I have a son who was diagnosed when he was 19 as bipolar and then later a schizophrenic. And then finally, Joe, he has the same diagnosis you do, the schizoaffective disorder and bipolar. He, as I said, is 28 now, and he's been dealing with it for 9 years. And I think it's only been in the last year and a half as a young man that he has decided, I actually have an illness. I think all the other times he tried to fight it with, I can do this myself, I don't need medication, and he would become homeless. He was homeless for a year somewhere in Indiana, and I could not find him for a year. But he decided, like I said, over maybe it was 2 years ago, that he was really finally going to accept the fact that he has an illness, and he has the constant voices that you have, and I just, as a parent, he didn't have an abusive situation growing up. His father did leave when he was young, but when he was diagnosed, he was in college with a double scholarship, and all of a sudden, this just—it seemed like depression when he was a high school student. I thought it was because of the father leaving and such, but it did develop. And we do have history in our family as well of two of my siblings with bipolar disorder. But I didn't know what advice you have for family. We talk very honestly and openly. When he starts stopping in the middle of a sentence or looking over to my shoulder or something, I can tell that they're talking, you know, he's hearing. So we automatically say, are you hearing stuff? And he'll say, yeah. Well, what are they saying? Is that a good thing to do? I mean, he seems to have some comfort that he can talk about it.
Karen, we know this is a very painful subject. Joe, shed some light and try to help Karen out as far as some of the coping skills she can use and support skills she can use for her son.
Well, I think what she's doing is beautiful. If you're willing to sit there and let him share the voices with you without judging them, I think this is just my personal view. I've noticed underneath the voices, there's always something that they're trying to say that's real.
Yes.
And so yes. I try to get what that is. It's just their way, my way of delivering it. And many times, mm-hmm. if you just hear that, maybe you can kind of pull it out. And when you can't, I don't think it hurts to turn and say, you know, that one didn't make sense.
I do say that.
Yeah.
I said, you know, that's not right, don't you? Because, you know, they say, I'm a loser, or they'll just say, you're a sorry person. They say that to him a lot. And and I said, you know, that's not right, you know. But I know he hears it. I don't. But he is in the mental health system now, finally, and he's graduated to where he's in a kind of a semi-assisted living apartment, which is huge.
Nice. The only question I want you to keep him asking himself, you know, the disease can keep you in the negative. So the only thing that I think is vital, the question that I started asking literally 30 years ago that I think ultimately was a blessing to me is, what can I do? I know I've got struggles, but what can I do? And what does this disease look like in me? Because if I can get real on both ends of that, maybe I've got a fighting chance.
Thank you for your sharing your thoughts, Karen. Talk about that fighting chance, Joe.
Well, 30 years ago at 22, when I woke up from trying to kill myself, I had two thoughts go through my head. The first was, great, I can't even do that right. And I'd been in a coma 3 days, and I thought, I can't even kill myself right. Now what? And the second thing that went through my head was, what if there was a God, and what if he really wanted me to live? And so I started then talking to that God and saying, if you're there, if you're real, if you'll save me, if you'll help me, I'll spend the rest of my life telling people about that. And I began to ask this question. I read a scripture in Romans 12 that it's a tiny scripture, but it said taking renewing my mind and taking captive every thought. And for some reason, I literally took that verse literal. And I began to believe it was possible. As I began to change, the doctors back then would say, no, you can't rewire your brain. It's set at 12 months. And I would say, I don't know, something's happening. And sure enough, it was. And I'm glad I believed that, because I think it saved me, even though the truth is I don't know, you know, what was real and what wasn't back then. You know,
Joe Holt is a father, husband, counselor, and Lee's Summit resident. He's also a diagnosed schizophrenic who has on numerous occasions attempted to take his own life, but now is employing his own brand of coping. Join the conversation, Kansas City. Get involved. 816-235-2888. 816-235-2888. We're going to pause for a break, but when we return, the role of psychotherapy and spirituality in Joe Holt's life and how he reconciles the two. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Joe Holt, who has come back from the brink of suicide due to support from church, family, and a philosophy gleaned from experience and his role as a counselor with the Comforting Faith Services that helped him cope with the reality of his schizophrenia. Mr. Holt was recently featured in a New York Times article titled Learning to Cope with the Mind's Taunting Voices. Kansas City, join the conversation. Also, for those suffering with mental illness or having loved ones who do, how have approaches toward your own mental health changed since your diagnosis or your loved one's diagnosis? What coping mechanisms have worked for you? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Joe, how does faith help you in these moments of intense episodes of schizophrenia?
Well, having the belief that there is a scientist, a academician who created everything, who knows everything, and who allowed me to be created this way, allows me to believe that he's got a long-term plan, whether I see it or not, whether it comes true in this world or the next, it helps me a great deal.
Intelligent design, so to speak.
Intelligent design.
We're going to go to Sarah in Midtown. Welcome to Central Standard, Sarah.
Hi. I really want to thank you for having this show. This is really important, and it doesn't get talked about very much. I also have mental health issues, and I really like that suddenly you're talking about therapy and spirituality, because that has been huge for me, and I feel like I have come such a long way, really, because of both of those things together. But the comment that I called with, which is why I was even scared to call, is that the hardest thing for me in a lot of ways has been people's misunderstandings and a lot of prejudice about mental health. There's not as much, well, there's a lot of treatment available, but insurance doesn't cover as much of it. People oftentimes sort of get nervous and back off when you tell them that you have mental health issues. So for a long time, I don't tell people. And I spend a lot of time basically trying to hide it and look good.
Well, Sarah, let me pose this question to you, and I was going to pose it to Joe. What do you say to people who say, well, you know, mental illness is like cancer. It's like diabetes. You just go get treated, and it'll be all right. Is it like cancer? Is it like diabetes? Is it like a normal visit to the doctor where you go, get a prescription, and you're good?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, even the use of the word normal there kind of points to something. And, you know, all I can talk about is really my issue, which is dissociative identity disorder, anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress. Et cetera, et cetera. There are medications that can help, but that doesn't fix it. It can help you be able to deal with it better. But really, for me, the thing that has really helped more than anything else is therapy and my spirituality. Those are the things that have really, really helped. I mean, not that the medication isn't important, but you can't just take a pill.
Right. So, Joe, chime in on that, if you will. Is the sort of dual reality, the dual coping mechanism of therapy and spirituality essential to your journey?
I believe it is. I believe there are four things that you have to do in order to be successful. The first thing for me, and I take them in this order, by the way, spiritually, you have to decide, is there not a God? What does that mean to me? If there's not a God and I'm just a blog, then I've got one chance to get it right. It should motivate you either way. If you have faith, it should motivate you that there's some master plan and the game's just not over. And I hate that word, but I hope you understand what I mean. The second thing is intellectually. I have to sit there and think, what do I need to learn? What do I need to understand? What do I need to know to get better with this? Emotionally, I believe emotionally I have to really get into the social skills, the emotional handicaps that I may have or may not have, and I have to learn how to think more objectively rather than allowing emotions to rule me during these episodes. And then finally, bodily. What is the disease? What medicines will help? What therapy will help? What can I do, such as exercise or anything? What can I do? And along all of those lines is join in with others like your family and trust them.
Thank you, Sarah, for sharing with us. We're going to go to Bob in KCK. Bob.
Hi. Yes.
Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I think what's the hardest for me, I've been diagnosed with depression, PTSD, and possibly bipolar. And, for example, in social settings where I know I'm going to see people on a regular basis, even if I'm upfront about it and say, hey, you know, this is how I am. But I am on medications, so everything's going to be fine. Some think it's either kind of funny, not in a cruel way, but okay, they laugh it off, probably a little uncomfortable. And then But as soon as I do have kind of a mental break and I get show some paranoia and that sort of thing, it becomes more maybe than they can handle, and I understand that. It is awkward for them. And as far as the voices go, I don't know that I actually have a voice doing it, but sometimes I have a thought that just says, no matter how hard I try, nothing works. Wouldn't it be easier just to be done with it?
That's understandable, Bob. Do you feel like people freak out on you or unpeel the layers of your onion, and do you feel a sense of abandonment based on your bipolar or traits coming out?
That's a good way to put it, abandonment. And it's not necessarily mean-spirited, but I don't know how to explain it.
I don't think you have to. I think it's fear. Everyone is afraid of their glitch, and everyone has a glitch. Ours happens to be inside our brain, and yet you meet people with physical ailments all the time. We don't judge them for that, and yet we do this. I think it's the fear, the intensity that's created around it is what people can't handle, and that's what makes it so hard to share it with people because they're afraid of it.
And they mock what they don't understand or fear what they don't understand.
When the truth is, I've never met a person without a glitch in my life. It's just, where is that functional glitch and how does it affect you? And if you really get to know each person, they've got one. And it helped me to accept mine, whether other people did or not.
So in reality, in your opinion, mental illness is, it's not cancer. It's not diabetes. It's not these other sort of medically treatable things that you can get off work for and be excused and go treat.
Well, I believe it does have a physical component to it, and to deny that would be wrong. It's just the severity of it. We don't, you know, if a person has a severe case of cancer and is unable to work, or we don't think much of that. We don't judge them at all for that. On the other side of the coin, if a person is able to work, I think they should try their best to try to be as productive a human being as they can be. At least that was my approach. I couldn't tolerate the thought of being unwilling to work if I was able. I wasn't sure I was able, and I had to discover that.
We're going to go to Liz in the Northland. Liz, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I wanted to share kind of the spouse's perspective. I appreciate so much the positive ability to discuss mental health and give hope to those who are struggling with it and those who love people who are struggling with it. My husband was diagnosed and has continually struggled with major depressive disorder, with anxiety, self-injurious behavior, as well as tendency towards substance abuse.
Self-medication, and, huh?
Yeah, it started out as that, yes.
So do you have a question for Joe, Liz?
I wanted to thank him for you know, speaking about his wife and speaking about the fact that he has children and a job and things that his life can level out, and showing that there is another side and hope for happiness for those who love individuals with mental health difficulties.
Yeah, thank you. I wouldn't have made it without my wife. I would not have made it. So,
thank you, Liz, for sharing your story. Speaking of not making without what seems to be, based on what we've read in the New York Times and based on what you've said here today, a very, very supportive wife, how has your role in family life changed during your recovery?
Well, my wife in the initial stages didn't really believe mental illness was real. So it actually turned towards my favor because she challenged me continuously to try to be the best I can be. As time has gone, I think she's grown to understand it more. I've grown to not make excuses with it more. And that's helped both of us in many ways. Did that answer your question? I've kind of lost sight of your question.
It did. I was going to follow up with, how does she cope now that she does know that this is very real?
Well, I think she's enjoying her life now because I'm not quite the same as I was. But for many years, I don't know how she coped. I don't think I deserved to keep her. I personally think it was a great gift, and I'm very grateful that she stuck it out with me.
We're going to go to Ben in Overland Park. Ben, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. In my case is a combination of Liz and what your guest has just revealed. My spouse was diagnosed as being bipolar with a personality disorder. However, both doctors called it sudden onset. In other words, she was perfectly fine until about age 45 when it occurred. She would not take the medications that they suggested in the counseling, which they said would ultimately help her, like your guest. And it ultimately tore our family asunder. And she did all kind of weird things, became a drug and alcohol abuser, quit being a den mother and got DUIs, and her whole life has degenerated over the past several years into nothingness. I wonder if you've heard of people that get it later in life without any family warning or history or anything up to that point.
Joe, it's described as a chemical imbalance in the levels of serotonin and other chemical elements of the brain that in turn affect the mind, and self-medication is very, very, very common because it's more socially acceptable to stumble drunk down the street than it is to say, I'm bipolar, excuse me, why I go take these pills. So how do you deal with that? What's your advice for Ben?
I don't know that I have direct advice without knowing more about it. The thing that impresses me the most is we want to say it's chemical. I believe there's also a wiring issue that we're just now beginning to explore through neurology and things of that nature. I also believe that in life you can just crack. You can just say a part of you just shuts down or goes berserk or loses it. And I think anybody that does not appreciate, the brain is the most complex organ in the universe. If you do not appreciate the fact that it has the potential to glitch just like any other part of the body, then I doubt very seriously that you're going to understand. I've met people that have had onset later in life, and they're so shocked by it because they used to judge people like me, and now they understand, and my heart goes out. I do believe it's possible to get it at any time.
The brain is also a big emitter and conductor of electric pulses.
Electricity and chemicals. That's
run
what it
our,
does.
That run our nervous system, too, so yeah. That's very key. You're listening to an amazingly powerful story from Joe Holt, a Lee Summit resident who is diagnosed as a schizophrenic and has come back from the brink of self-destruction and suicide to a productive, thriving career, a fulfilling fatherhood, and a strong marriage to become a counselor, and he's a computer programmer for the Marines. That's an amazing story. Joe, he's our guest today on Central Standard, 89.3 FM, KCUR, and streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Join the conversation about whether you and your loved one have dealt with mental illness and how you've dealt with mental illness. 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Joe, as a counselor, when you hear people's cases, like you've heard some of these callers today, are there or were there ever moments where you were uncomfortable?
Yes. Fortunately, one of the first things you learn in school is even if our bodily and mental reactions are exactly the same, even if we came from the exact same history, my story is not theirs. And I have to keep in mind that this is a unique journey. And there are moments I've said that this isn't – I can't do this. Sometimes because it hits too close. I have a weight issue. I'm not going to do therapy for weight, people with weight issues. On the other side of the coin, there are times I adore doing therapy around this, and there are times when I have to excuse myself.
You said in the New York Times article there are moments when the voices get louder and more volatile. There are moments when anxiety reaches peaks that become kind of dangerous. So what do you do in those moments to calm down and step back and stay objective, as you were saying?
Breathing is a great friend. Breathing and smells go directly to the brain. So if I breathe for 2 minutes at least, it helps calm me. I'll put beautiful smells around me that help calm me. I'll step outside and watch nature. I'll put on music. I will sometimes just close my eyes and just try to rest. I have to decide in those moments, those crucial moments, do I fight it or do I not? And it's a judgment call.
It certainly is a judgment call. We're going to go to Crystal in Overland Park. Crystal.
Hello.
Hello, Crystal. How are you?
Okay.
You all right? You good?
Yeah, this is like my first time on.
I know. I know. I can tell. Tell us your story, Crystal.
I'm 16 years old, and I've been diagnosed with depression and bipolar and adolescent schizophrenia, my father says. I guess that's a scientific name for something. But, I just wanted to say that, even though sometimes I, hear things or see things that other people can't, and, sometimes I've had cases where they will tell me to hurt myself or hurt somebody else, I always try to think, if I was to do this, if I was to do what they said, how would this affect me and how would it affect those I love around me? And what true reason is there to actually do that?
So, Crystal, how do you avoid doing that? How do you calm the voices down? What's your method, Crystal?
My method is basically hanging out with my friends, trying to stay happy. And if it gets, I'll go in my room with, one of my pets, one of my cats or something, and pet them to calm myself down and listen to some music that, expresses how I'm feeling.
Who do you like, Crystal? Who do you listen to?
I'll listen to some hard rock music or I'll listen to, depends. If it's, really, really bad, I'll listen to, really loud music, trying to drown it out. And if it's not as bad, then I might listen to something that's softer and stuff like that. That way, it helps express how bad it is.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing. This is a very courageous Crystal, and we applaud you on your journey and your courage, and keep listening to that music.
Can I talk to her a second?
Please, Joe.
I'm going to tell you something. I hear in you a great intelligence and maturity. Remember, this is a marathon, and keep learning from it. Keep challenging yourself. You just sound to me like you're really trying to think this through. Use that side of your brain. I believe that our greatest weaknesses are connected to our greatest strengths, and obviously your greatest weakness is here, but your great strength is there. You've got a great mind. Remember that other side. You just seem to me like you're really on top of this, and I hope that you look at this marathon, this long run, that your story isn't over yet, and someday I believe God's going to use it. You have to believe that and really challenge yourself not to just give in to life. Avoid alcohol or anything that would change the chemicals in your brain, because I'm telling you, I can hear in you just a great wisdom for your age. Take advantage of that, please. You're really on a great path.
Go get them, Crystal. Thank you, Joe, for expounding upon that. You've gotten a lot of attention since the New York Times article, and probably, I hate to say it, unfortunately, more after appearing here on Central Standard. How are you dealing with being so frank and telling your story and sharing your life, man? Literally sharing your life.
Well, once I made the commitment to do it, I decided I wasn't going to worry about the repercussions anymore. I've got to try to make a difference. And if I hide in a shell, I can't do that. I'm not a public figure at all. I'm just a regular, everyday guy. So I really have a lot of struggle with doing this, but I'm just hopeful that it makes a difference in somebody or somebody's life, and that somebody that thinks they don't have hope can say, in the long run, maybe, just maybe, you can have hope.
But you had a negative reaction to your article in the New York Times. Tell us what's happening right now.
You mean I've been accused all 31 years of being demon possessed. Is that what we're referring to? And I have a person who's trying to get a hold of me so they can perform an exorcism.
And their name is?
The Prophetess, I believe.
The Prophetess.
Yes,
I believe. They wrote in and commented.
And they've called my house many times and emailing and stuff, so.
How do you deal with that in addition to being an IT programmer for the Marines, a foster father, a husband, a counselor? Man, Joe, how do you corral all this?
I just try to be I'm sure of who I am. I'm sure of my beliefs. And if someone wants to believe that because I have a glitch in the brain that there's something demonic about me, they're just going to have to live with that because I'm not going to accept it.
Haters are going to hate.
Haters are going to hate.
Self-awareness versus self-esteem, how do you meld those concepts together?
Well, self-awareness to me is learning everything that I can about myself, my world, my personal struggle. Self-esteem to me is a decision that I make to constantly talk to myself in healthy ways, and I believe everyone needs to do that, not just me.
Was there ever a time, either in the past or even now, where you felt like your illness set you apart and that regardless of how deadly it could be, it was yours, and that's what makes you unique?
The truth is I used to think that – I used to brag about it in the early years because it defined me. And then I began to understand it was defining me in negative ways, and I refused to accept it that way. Then I went inside the closet with it because I was embarrassed by it for many years. So, yes.
One quick note. In one word, what's your life like in terms of fostering positivity? One word.
Unbelievable.
You're listening to a very inspirational and compelling story, the story of Joe Holt, a Lee Summit resident who was diagnosed as a schizophrenic and has come back from the brink of suicide to a productive, thriving career, a fulfilling fatherhood, a strong marriage, all to become a counselor, programmer, and comforting faith inspirational.
Thank you.
For Comforting Faith Counseling Services. Thank you so much for appearing on Central Standard, Joe Holt.
Thank you.
You'll find this show and our show's archives, podcast, blog, and a lot more at kcur.org. Go there and click on Central Standard. And while you're there, sign up to receive our weekly newsletter for upcoming programming. Tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with co-host Monroe Dodd as he talks to Dr. Delia Cook-Gillis about the conversation on African-American history in Kansas City. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, executive produced by Bill Anderson. We had help this week from Spencer Dudley and Tamika Witherspoon. Special thanks to Kim Noble in the announcer chair. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. What you're hearing right now is an outro by Sunday Night. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.